Accession number 18335, Reel 5.
So Leitman Reel 5.
I was very unhappy about going out to the Far East, but fortunately, when we got to Port Tewfik, we were told we were going to land there, which we did, and eventually I found myself down at a place called Kassassin in Egypt, and we stayed there for a few weeks, at which time the war in Japan was over, Hiroshima, one thing and another. And there was problems then in Palestine. So my section was sent from Egypt up to Palestine. And I was stationed at Rehovoth and in Jerusalem. And Sarafan camp, of course, which I think most people in Palestine had spent some time there. And the problems there between the Jews and the Arabs are well known. Peacekeeping role, rather like the Irish one today, I should think. Rather difficult. Neither side liked you. Neither side wanted you. And the day that they blew up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, the previous evening I'd been posted. And I'd left that morning to go to Greece, where the Greek Civil War was on. I took a detachment of 33 men, 30 Royal Signals and 3 RAF, and an officer, Captain McLaren. And we made our way down through Gaza, the Gaza Strip, down to Alexandria, and put on a troop ship, and eventually landed in Piraeus, Athens.
Before you go to Greece, any other memories of the conflict in Palestine?
Yes, it was very upsetting because, as I said, you had to be diplomatically correct. There were all sorts of nasty things happening from the Arabs. And the Jews, they just took you for, you had to be there, and they respected that, and you were probably looking after their interests. And there's another thing which did upset me. I was there at the time when the refugees were coming in, the Windrush boat, and other people that were escaping from Europe, you know, and had bought their way, as they thought, to their promised land. And again, I suppose I felt a bit bitter about it because I found myself on a naval patrol boat on one occasion with a wireless set, keeping in touch with small units of the British Navy and army units ashore, and we were looking for illegal immigrants coming in on small boats. Now, I thought, here's my brother-in-law who joined up 12 months after me, and he'd come out 12 months before me, and I was doing virtually a naval job for him. And I thought, you know, why? It seemed at the time rather unfair that with the release numbers, and mine was 38, and I'd volunteered, don't forget, for the duration. Of course, what we didn't know at the time was, what was the duration of the Japanese War, which wasn't on when I joined up. The German War had long since been over, but here they were getting us for all these other conflicts, and some of my friends went out to Malaysia, where there's more problems. In fact, one of them lost his life out there, another one lost his eyesight. So it made you feel a bit bitter. Why are we being kept on? And of course, the answer was, you're specialized troops. Anyway, I did feel, I'm obeying orders, but it's my conscience clear. You saw these people come in, and I actually saw one dear old lady kiss the ground, much as they, I'm here, Mecca, to be turned around and ushered back on the boat. And I thought that broke my heart, really. And I did hear of cases, although it never happened to me, of young girls who offered their bodies to troops to let them stay in Israel. And I can imagine it's to be true, because they were coming off in droves and being interrogated by just ordinary soldiers, you know. But I felt genuinely sorry for them, because I'd seen all this refugee problem in France and Belgium and Holland, you know, saw how they suffered, and I could well imagine how some of these people had suffered with both the Germans and the Russians. And to think they'd got all that way, all that far down, across on the boats from France and Italy, to be refused at the last stage. They only wanted a place to live peacefully, quietly. But that was the orders, no more. And I felt very bewildered and bitter about that. But as I say, orders were orders. You obey them. And that sometimes, when you say about the Germans and the Nazis and that, the ordinary soldier obeyed orders. Whether they were atrocities or not, you can't say. They weren't the fiendish Nazi that was inbred in them for cruelty. I suppose the same happened with the Japanese. Some of these are so cruel that it's unbelievable. But if it was a question of you do it or else, I suppose you do it. Happily, I've never been in that position. I certainly wouldn't see my mother or my wife or friends ill-treated or raped or anything like that.
When do you think that you left Palestine?
Well, as I say, I left Palestine the day after the King David Hotel was blown up. So that would be 1945 or 46. And I had a very interesting experience in Greece because, again, there was all the problems there with the Greek government. It's not generally known, but a lot of good Greek Air Force flyers were in the RAF, even from the Battle of Britain days. And they went back to Greece to try and form a new Air Force and take over the country, you know. Put it back on a stable footing, and they sought our help. And again, there was a BBC correspondent called Kenneth Matthews, and he was captured by the ELAS and taken up as a hostage amongst other journalists and people. And we were looking for him and others and trying to keep law and order in the various streets. All these different factors were warring with each other and, you know, fighting, bloodshed. And then Captain McLennan and I took this detachment from Athens right up through the Greek mountains, past Olympus, through Larissa, Lamia, up into Thessalonica. And I had one very interesting experience on this journey. We'd stopped for the night, and I noticed that my wristwatch, well, I suppose all the salt and or lack of salt, had eaten through the leather strap, and it fell on the floor when we made this brief stop. And some of the Greek villagers had come out, and a little boy picked up the watch. And before I could stop him, he said, "Rap," and he disappeared. And my lads laughed. They said, "He's too quick for you. He'd gone with my watch." So you can imagine my surprise next morning when this little lad appeared with the watch and a brand new strap put on it. Beautiful strap. This boy would only be about 12 or 13. So I thanked him profusely. I think we gave him a few tins of bully beef and that. And he took my hand and said, "Come with me." So we weren't ready to move off. So I went with him. And we went about must have been a quarter of a mile up this rugged place, past the old gnarled olive trees and all really rough country. And we went into this stone house, very dilapidated. And there was, as I thought, this old man. And when he saw me, he got up, he extended his hand, he shook his hand, and I gathered, you know, between us, the boy, the old man, and myself, that he was the man who'd repaired my watch and put the leather strap on. And I thanked him, and we tried to make ourselves understood. I wanted to, incidentally, I had all the unit money on me to pay out, over 1,000,000 drachma. So I can say I slept on 1,000,000 drachma. But I offered to pay him money, but he wouldn't hear of it, so he gave him some tins of food and all the rest of it. And I noticed he was had tears in his eyes. And he rolled his sleeve up, and on the top was his concentration camp number. And he'd been in Dachau. And he was one of the few survivors, and he'd come back afterwards. And he said, I cannot thank you enough. So, a little place like that makes you think, doesn't it? And then you talk about a small coincidence. We made our way further on up towards Salonika, and we met another British convoy, the only one we saw in the whole days. And we stopped and exchanged greetings, and one of my men came up and said, there's a fellow here says he knows you. He said, you're from Cornwall, aren't you? I said, well, yes. And he said, just on chance, he said, what are you? He said, we're Royal Corps of Signals. Oh, he said, I knew a fellow in the Royal Corps of Signals called Ken Lakeman. I don't suppose you've ever heard of him. He said, heard of him? He's our section sergeant. And it was a fellow I'd been to school with. And I hadn't seen him since before the war. And just, you know, almost on a mountaintop in Greece. I mean, the long arm of coincidence, isn't it? Makes you think.
Did you have any contact with the conflict in Greece?
Not directly, no. We kept out of it again. We were there more or less on a policing mission as it was. There was sporadic firing in Athens and some of the other cities. And so was there any political maneuvers, you know, the cabinets and that, they would start up flare-ups and everything else. But I think our brief was to make sure there's no rioting, no bloodshed, wherever possible. And, of course, we were there to support the Greek Air Force and the Greek Army if things had deteriorated further. We never had any casualties in Greece.
Were you still with this same unit, the Second Air Support Signals?
Yes, we were a part of that, yes. And we were seconded. The main body of that stayed in Palestine. But
so you were supporting the RAF?
Yeah.
Did you come across any hostility from Greek people?
No. I find the Greek people very, very nice indeed. And one thing that really stuck in my mind, we were scheduled, reputed to be going up to Bulgaria on a goodwill mission. And we'd actually set off through the plains of Macedonia, and orders came through that we were to stop and return to Salonika. No reason given, but afterwards we were told that because of the communistic influence in Bulgaria, they felt that a British Army unit, particularly signals, intelligence corps and things like that, would not be welcomed there. We were treated with utmost suspicion, and the British government felt that no way should we carry on with this, whatever mission we were supposed to be doing. And incidentally, they found this British correspondent, this Kenneth Matthews, and one or two others that had been missing and held as hostages, so our role really was over. But going through this plain of Macedonia, which was pretty bare of lots of old olive trees and porous land, I suddenly came across this oasis, if you like, beautiful green. And to my amazement, there was a British War Graves Commission cemetery there. And this couple came out to greet us, elderly, greeted us most warmly, the first British they'd seen for years. And we went in and had tea with him, and he told me a fascinating story. He'd been in charge of this War Graves Commission, and I said, where are you situated? I said, you're too far away from the Dardanelles and from Gallipoli, but you have all these graves here. I forget the exact number, there were several hundred. And he said, well, yes, he said, they were to do with the conflict in the First World War, mainly. And he said, there's only some 60 or 70 graves here, which are Second World War. They're nearly all pilots or air crew that have been shot down or, you know, and people that had arrived on SAS missions, if you like, in Greece and Yugoslavia and that area and passed away, not necessarily killed in action, but died. But what impressed me was how beautifully this cemetery had been kept. And I can only liken it to some of the cemeteries we have today in Normandy and places. And he told me that when he was there pre-war, I forget exactly when he went, back in the 30s, I think he said he went there, and he brought his family up there. But when war was inevitable, he sent his family home, because they were fairly grown up then. But his wife decided to stay with them, and they stayed there and look after this place and were paid by the British government. But I said, how did you manage all this yourself? He said, it was the Greek people that helped us voluntarily to keep this in order. They're all our friends. They're our family. And rather than come back to England, they'd stay there. And I thought that was wonderful. And I said, well, will they be paid for this work they've done? He said, well, we hope to get some payment for them. And I often wonder if they did.
How long did you stay in Greece for?
I suppose about 6 or 7 months. I came back in, I think I was demobbed in November 1946.
How do you feel now about having served in the Second World War?
Proud, and a wonderful experience for a man of my age. I mean, I went in a boy of 18, I came out a man. 24, 25 nearly.
Did it leave any mark or scar with you?
Difficult to say. I suppose, yes, your attitude had changed a great deal. You'd learned so much. You'd grown up. You'd missed your boyhood, if you like. You'd missed your youth. And most of all, like the old crack, I gave the best years of my wife to the army. You know, I was married in 1942, so I was away till 1946. So there's 4 years that we were not separated all the time, but certainly apart. And wrote virtually every day we could, whenever possible anyway. And yes, it was a wonderful experience. And of course, as I said, I'm one of the lucky ones. I came through unscathed, but so many didn't. And I was reminded of that very much so when we went over for the 40th anniversary to D-Day. And they were in the Bayeux Cemetery, and the Queen was delivering an address there. And the parade marshal got us all to move up without standing and desecrating the graves. The tallest ones at the back, shorter ones at the front, and move up, till you couldn't move any further. And there I stood, and in front of me there was 5 Royal Signal graves. And obviously, a wireless detachment such as my own had been hit, and the corporal, who was 24, and his number was 2598881. I was 2598873. So his number was 8 more than me. So he probably, if he didn't join up the same day as me, he probably joined up the next day. But the point I'm trying to make is, his number was up, and mine wasn't. And I always remember that.